We're used to this.
So is it everybody Facebook?
Or yeah, no, it's everybody. I mean, Ami asked me to do it, so. More people learning Torah. Okay, my friends, we're going to learn some Gemara tonight. We are going to learn some Gemara tonight. We are going to learn about burning the mitzvah oil. The mitzvah oil. Well, for Hanukkah, that's a good question. So, the Gemara that we're learning is about Hanukkah, right? That's what this Gemara is about. And we talked about kindling the menorah, how you should, how you shouldn't, what should and should not be done in the performance of this mitzvah, where it should be lit, when it should be lit, all these things have been discussed. Now, a long time ago, when we started this whole series, we began the story of Hanukkah by first discussing the concept of not the Hanukkah menorah, Neirot Shabbat. We started off by talking about Neirot Shabbat. That's why this is kind of put into Masechet Shabbat. That's the connection to Masechet Shabbat. Hanukkah and Shabbat are really not connected, per se. Hanukkah is for 8 days. You can have either one or two Shabbatot in a Hanukkah, but it's not really connected to the mitzvah of Shabbat. In fact, the Neirot, the candles, the flames, the lamps of Hanukkah are vastly different from the candles or lamps that we kindle for Shabbat. In fact, they're totally opposite. When it comes to the Shabbat candles, the purpose is we should be able to use its light. We should benefit from its light. When it comes to the Hanukkah candles, ein lanu rishut. We have no permission l'shtamesh ben to use them. So actually, they're polar opposites. How then do they end up together? How do they become these strange bedfellows, Shabbat candles and Hanukkah candles? The answer is, they're both candles. They're both lamps. And since it's the only two mitzvahs that we have to kindle, a yahrzeit candle is not a mitzvah. So this way, these two mitzvahs get put one next to the other. All right. Now, when we started this whole discussion, because we were talking about the idea of what you may or may not use for Shabbos candles, we drew a distinction, a difference between what you can use for the Hanukkah menorah, which may not be good for Shabbos. We talk about different kinds of fuel which would not be effective, which would not be useful on Shabbat, because we may end up violating the Shabbat would we use such fuel. But for Hanukkah, it wouldn't present a problem at all. Now the Gemara, on the surface, rather oddly, interjects this layered discussion of Hanukkah and gives us a throwback Thursday. We're going to talk about something we haven't discussed for the longest time, since the beginning of the sugya. The whole series began with a discussion of different kinds of fuel, and we learned in the Mishnah, we're in the bottom of Daf Chav Gimel Amud Beis, page 23, side 2. And the Gemara gives us a quote. And the quote is, V'lei b'shemen sreifa, that the Shabbat candles, or the Shabbat lamps, cannot be lit with oil that is burnt. Shemen sreifa. What does burnt oil look like? What is burnt oil?
It's normally discolored. Yeah.
It's discolored? Who cares what color oil is?
No, but it's...
You know the story? This lady went to buy a pulka, some chicken, and she said to the butcher, "This pulka is broken. I want a discount." He said, "Lady, you want to make chicken soup or you want to dance with the chicken?" Who cares if the pulka is broken? I care if the oil is discolored. What do you mean burnt oil? What do you mean burnt oil? Oil burns. That's what oil does. Oil burns. Burnt oil isn't oil anymore. It's gone. And if it's there, it's not burnt. What does Shemen Seifa? Why would that be an issue? That's how the Gemara introduced the discussion. My Shemen Seifa. What is burnt oil? What is this oil that's contraband, that's prohibited for use? 23B3. Okay. So the Gemara now clarifies. My shemen sreifa. Omar Rabba said, Shemen shel teruma shenitma. Shemen sreifa is oil that's a byproduct of teruma that became ritually impure. So let me give you a little bit of background. Some of you know about this. Some of you may not remember, or some of you maybe never heard of it. Just give you a quick background there so we should be able to appreciate what the Gemara is saying. Because the Gemara introduces a whole range of topics, and unless you have the background, you're not going to understand what's going on. So it all begins with a land that's called Eretz Yisrael, the Holy Land. What makes a land holy? It's got soil like any other soil, dirt like any other dirt. What makes it sacred? And the answer is, Hashem says this land is holy, and therefore the food that grows there has a special designation, because the land is holy. So food that grows out of sacred soil is also sacred. And we know when things are sacred, things are holy, we're not supposed to use it. Think about the Hanukkah menorah. Hanerot halalu kodeshem. These lamps, these flames are holy. In lana rishush lishtamet ben. We can't use them. We have that. It's holy. Sacred. So what do? So the Torah says, you take this holy produce, you separate a small amount of it, and it becomes like a homeopathic transformation. We take all the holiness, and we kind of have it dwell or reside on a small portion of a large crop. So that small portion becomes super holy, and regular people can't eat it. And it's called teruma, because the word teruma comes from the terminology to lift, to elevate, to separate. What are you going to do with this holy food? Ah. There is a special tribe of Jews, and they're called Kohanim. Not really a tribe, like a subsection of a tribe, or a family. And we say it in our Al HaNisim prayer on Chanukah. We say, Al Yidei Kohanecha HaKadoshim. So there's a certain holiness that a Kohen possesses. But this is not a holiness that comes from a lot of Torah learned, much effort expended on davening, many mitzvahs performed. This is a holiness that's innate. It's innate. You're born that way. Either you have it or you don't.
It's inherent.
It's a?
Inherent.
It's inherent. That's correct. Now this inherent holiness allows you to do certain things that other Jewish people cannot do. For example, where's the holiest place on planet Earth?
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. Very good. That's the holiest city. And what's the holiest part of Jerusalem? The Temple Mount. And when the Beis HaMikdash is built, then the Temple Mount ground is fully activated. And when the Temple Mount ground is fully activated, what happens then? Then we have a holy, sacred space. And in the holy, sacred space, not everybody's supposed to go. Who's permitted to go?
Kohanim.
Why are they permitted to go there? Because they're doing holy things. And then there's the holiest of the holiest, Kodesh HaKadoshim. Who goes there? The holiest of the Kohanim. When does he go there? On the holiest day of the year. Now, when the Jewish people would come to the Beit HaMikdash, they would afford them many opportunities to nurture a more profound relationship with God. And the primary vehicle of convention for this deeper, more profound relationship was known as korbanot, which is very badly translated as sacrifices. It's a really bad translation. Sacrifice is a Greek word, and it has nothing to do with korbanot, because a korban is a Hebrew word that comes from the terminology of kiruv, of closeness. The korban is an act of closeness, nurturing, cultivating closeness with Hashem. So the korban, on a technical level, looks like a Greek sacrifice. That's what people call it, a sacrifice, but it's really an offering. It's an offering of closeness. And this offering that nurtures closeness, there's something called a korban ola. Ola means it ascends entirely. It's consumed on the altar. And then there's other kind of korbanot. So why would a Jew bring a korban?
To be close.
To be close. Why suddenly does he have to try and be close? Because he became far. So that's called a korban chatas. That's called a sin offering. So the sin offering says, I became distanced. Because I became distanced, I now want to culture, I should say, I want to cultivate and nurture a closeness. I want to make up for what went wrong. So part of the korban chatas gets burnt on the mizbeach. And what happens to the rest of it? The kohanim consume it. As the Gemara says, kohanim ochlim ubalim mitkaprim. The kohanim eat, and the owners, the people who brought the offering, are atoned for, cleansed. Their relationship with God is repaired. So in other words, the kohanim are given a special holiness, and that special holiness enables them to consume holy things and accomplish something special because they eat the holy food. Here's an easy example. We, the Jewish people, are actually a holy people. We're called Hashem's holy nation. Because we're Hashem's holy nation, on a very holy night of the year, which is called Leil HaSeder, on that holy night of the year, we are given the opportunity to eat something which is called matzah. And when you eat matzah, your faith is nurtured. And you make a bracha, Asher Kiddishanu, which means Asher Kiddishanu, he has hallowed us, made us holy, the mitzvotav, with his mitzvot, the tzivanu, and he gave us a commandment. When the Kohen eats special food that only the Kohen's allowed to eat, he also makes a bracha. What bracha does he make? Asher Kiddishanu, B'kedushato shel Aharon. The holiness of Aharon. First Kohen. He's the progenitor of the Kohen. So you make a bracha when your Kohen does the Kohanic blessings. What bracha does he make? Asher Kedushanu, he hallowed us. B'kedushato shel Aharon. So now you understand that the Kohen is given a special holiness, which means he's able to eat things which are very holy. And when the Kohen eats things which are very holy, what happens? Something special happens. Something good happens. Like when you do a mitzvah, something good happens. All right, now let's take it to the next step. So we talked about offerings. Now let's go from offerings, let's go out to the field. And you're going to see later, there's a reason that I gave you this whole song and dance about offerings. This is a very, very important connection. They're not mutually exclusive, at least not necessarily. So this holy food is holy, the produce is holy, not because it was brought to the temple. The produce is holy because it was lifted from holy produce. So produce was lifted from holy produce and designated as the holy produce. So what happens to this special lifted food now? It's very holy. It's very holy. So if it's very holy, who's going to eat it? Kohanim. Little caveat. For the Kohanim to eat it, they have to be in a state of holiness. What could stop you from being in a state of holiness? When you're ritually impure. So if a Kohen's ritually impure, can he eat the truma? No. The truma? No. No. So when the Kohanim want to eat the truma, they have to make sure they go to the? Excellent. How does the first tractate of Talmud begin? With the mitzvah of reading the Shema. And when should you read the Shema? When the Kohanim are coming home from the mikveh. Because you have to have not only an immersion in a mikveh, but you also have to have what's called Harav Shemesh, that the heavens are cleansed of light pollution and they become transparent. And you can see this. So now we know that the Kohanim have to be in a state of ritual purity. What happens if the Kohen is pure, but the Truma itself became defiled? What happens? Can you put food in the mikveh? That's correct. You cannot put food in the mikveh. What are you going to do with this holy food now? This holy food is ruined. This holy food cannot be consumed in holiness. And because it cannot be consumed in holiness, if somebody were to eat it, what would happen? Big sin. We got a problem. We have an issue here. We have food that was super holy, but unfortunately, it became defiled. Jerusalem, we have a problem. What's the answer? You have to get rid of it. What happens if you leave poison on the table? Just leave cyanide around. Maybe mix it in with the candies. Good idea?
Absolutely.
Very bad idea. Why? Because, you know, somebody might end up eating the cyanide. So what do we do with things which are dangerous?
Brilliant.
We destroy it. We destroy it. You don't leave it around. So what happens to the truma that was supposed to be really super holy, eaten in a super holy way, accomplishing super holy things, and it's tamei? What are you going to do with it?
Burn it.
Excellent, burn it. So what's the name of this shemen? What do you call this oil which has to be burnt? What do we call it? No, shemen seifa. Burnt oil. It wasn't burnt yet, but it means it has to be burnt. Understand? The Gemara says, Va'amai karula shemen seifa. Why do you call it burnt oil? You left it at the barbecue. The Gemara answers, no, I call it burnt oil, hoil, since ulasreifa omed. It's standing for burning. It doesn't mean standing, it's a euphemism. It means that's what it's slated for. So when people have something that's designated for a certain purpose, what is it called? Oftentimes, we refer to it in language that refers to its designated purpose. You understand? Something which could be designated to be used for a holy purpose, we would call it holy, even if it's not holy yet. But it's designated to be used for a holy purpose. This is designated. It's not even just designated. We have nothing else to do with it. It's slated for destruction. Because it's slated for destruction, what would we call it? Burnt? Destroyed? Sometimes people in an office, they go through the office and they go through files. And you have to keep them for like 5 years, I think, or 3 years, or how long do you keep your files for? But the files, 5 years? A lot of times files have confidential information. IT, important stuff. So what do you do with all this information? What do you do with all these old files?
Shred it.
Shred it. Whole business now, shredding, the shredding business. So when people put things in a box for shredding, what do they call it? That paper is called shredded. Shredded. It's not shredded yet. Well, it's designated to be shredded. That's what the Gemara is saying. It's very simple. That's why it's called Shemen Seifa. Doesn't that make sense? Okay. Excuse me. So now we know why it's called Shemen Seifa. Okay. Now that we've established what Shemen Seifa is, what's the next question we're probably going to ask? Why can't you use it on Shabbos? Aren't you burning it? Aren't you burning it?
Your Shabbos candles are as holy as your Hanukkah candles.
You know, what you're saying is really cool. You're talking about Shabbos candles and Hanukkah candles, and you should know that there is an opinion that the reason that we interject with this on the surface, totally off the track, Gemara is because the same would actually apply to Hanukkah candles as well. But that's not the point. Hanukkah candles burn, and Shabbos candles burn. And when they finish burning, what's left? Nothing. A wick, ashes. So what's wrong with using something which is designated to be burnt? What's wrong with using that for Shabbos candles, which get burnt? What's the difference? In the end, they all come out to the same place. You'll end up burnt. Ah, now we got a mitzvah. A mitzvah. I got to get rid of it. It's a mitzvah. It's a technicality. No. I can't give the tummy meat to somebody to eat because that would be a sin for him to eat it. Well, the mitzvah is to be mitzvah is to burn it. What's wrong with that? Right. So you're assuming that the burning of the shemen sreifa has to be an act of destruction that we don't benefit from. Which I will ask you, who says? That's a big chiddush. That's a big novelty. All I would say is the reason I have to burn it is so nobody should eat it. Who cares how it gets burned? Who cares if I get benefit? As long as it's burning. The main thing is it's gone. So this is the question. The Gemara says, Ube Shabbos, my time aloy. Okay, so now I get it. I know why it's called burnt oil. I understand that it has to be burnt. I get all this. So why can't I use it on Shabbos? So the Gemara answers, I'll tell you why. Mitoich shemitzvah alav levarei, because it's a mitzvah to burn it. Shema yata. Maybe he's going to bend or move or try to adjust the wick. This is a problem. What's the problem with Shema yata? What's the problem with tilting the wicks? On Shabbos, you're not allowed to cause combustion. So even if something is burning, but you adjust it so that the fire becomes a little bigger, you would be guilty of burning something on Shabbos. Not permitted. Not permitted? But the Gemara is saying something very deep here. Mitoich shemitzvah alav levarei, because it's a mitzvah to burn it. The gzeda, the concern is shema yata. Maybe you'll tilt it, but you'll tilt it because you want it to be burnt faster. Now let me tell you a little secret. I'll fill you into the background here. In the Rishonim, there's a discussion about the burning of this oil. If it's actually a mitzvah in and of itself, or as long as we end up with ashes, we're fine. An obvious distinction would be, what if I find a different way to get rid of it? What if I pour it down the drain? Would that be okay? Or does it have to be burnt? Let me talk to you about an example you're all familiar with. What do we as Jews burn? We do this every year, annually. We burn something. Chametz. There's a discussion if the chametz has to actually be burnt, or if the chametz can just be disposed of. The halacha is that the chametz can be disposed of. So why do we burn chametz in Erev Pesach?
To make sure that it's gone.
It's a custom. It's a custom. The Minchas Chinuch actually has a very big chiddush. He says, since the mitzvah of destroying the chametz only comes after noon passes, you should leave a little bit of chametz to noon and then burn it. But nobody does what the Minchas Chinuch says. We all burn our chametz before noon arrives. In other words, before there's an active mitzvah to destroy it. None of us ever actively fulfill the mitzvah of burning chametz. Hopefully we don't. Why? Because it's not about burning chametz. It's about getting rid of the chametz. Understand? As long as it's not there anymore, I'm fine. The point is, a Jew is not allowed to own chametz on Pesach. I don't care if you burn it. I don't care if you put it in acid. I don't care if you toss it into the Pacific. It doesn't make a difference to me how you got rid of it. The point is, it should be ownerless. I shouldn't own chametz. There's an opinion of Rabbi Yehuda that says you do have to burn it. We don't follow that. What do we do on Erev Shabbat, which is Erev Pesach? Which happens on occasion. What do? We flush the chametz down the toilet. That's what we do. We get rid of it a different way. But the question then comes, and this is why I started giving you this whole story of the Beis HaMikdash. What happens when a korban, when meat from an offering becomes defiled or expires? What happens? It's a mitzvah to burn it. It's a mitzvah to burn it. You cannot get rid of it. You have to burn it. And the question then becomes, since the holiness of the Kohen, who is ordained to eat holy foodstuff, is there's a link between offerings in Beis HaMikdash and Truma that comes from produce or grain of Eretz Yisrael. So then, just like you say that the offering, once its time is expired or becomes defiled, should be burnt, maybe there's a mitzvah to burn this as well. Now, if it's a mitzvah, we're going to go along with this idea that that is the opinion of the Gemara now. The Gemara's the opinion of of Rabba, who says that the reason you can't use it on Shabbos is because Shema Yata, that Rabba will hold that it's an actual mitzvah to do. Now, Jewish people are very funny people. Very funny people. Sometimes they don't do what Hashem wants. Sometimes they ignore what Hashem wants. All of us are guilty of this sometimes. But when you find a Jew who gets passionate about something Jewish, don't get in his way. We get really crazy. We go to the nth degree. We go to extremes. That's who we are. That's just the way it's always been. I'm telling you. Don't even try to change it. Guy could be so frum, he's totally crazy. That's what happens all the time. When we get caught up in the holiness of a mitzvah, we just get totally consumed by it. And here's the problem. Sometimes people get so consumed with the perceived holiness that they actually violate the Torah in their zest and zeal to do the right thing. It happens. So here's a person, in his mind, he's like mitzvah-oriented. He wants to burn the mitzvah oil. You guys got to burn that mitzvah oil, right? And he takes a look and he sees it's a little fire over there. It's not burning very well. But now he's into burning the mitzvah oil. He forgot that it was Shabbos, and he goes and he tilts it and tries to make the fire bigger because I got to do the mitzvah. So what are you doing? You can't do the mitzvah. Your mitzvah is coming with an aveda. Mitzvah, bob aveda is not a mitzvah. If the mitzvah comes from a sin, it's not a mitzvah at all. You know, like the guy who's so excited to wrap himself in a talus that he knocks out the person's eyes next to him with his tzitzis. All people do these crazy things because they get so caught up in the mitzvah that they forget to violate half the Torah on the way doing the mitzvah. Human nature, Jewish human nature. With the chachamim, have to be careful about nature because we're dealing with people, not malachim, not angels. And because you're dealing with people, people are people and people do funny things. So we have to do everything possible to ensure that nobody makes any mistakes. This is called setting up fences because it's very hard to walk on a tightrope. We'd fall off eventually. Can't walk in this narrow line. And because of that, the sages said, don't use it on Shabbos. Because if you use that kind of oil on Shabbos, because it's a mitzvah for it to burn, somebody will forget at some point. And because they will forget, you know what's going to happen? They're going to make the fire a little bigger and that violates Shabbos. There's a similar example to this, where we have a halacha that a person is not permitted to read a Torah scroll or book next to the flame on Friday night. Why? Shema Yata. Because maybe he won't read clearly. So he's looking in his Gemara, and he's so caught up looking in his Gemara, he's like, tilt the thing a little, you know. It's like today's day and age, you make the fire a little bigger. Once upon a time, you tilt the wick. You have a little, make the fire a little bigger. So what are you doing? It's Shabbos. You're learning Gemara Shabbos, and you're busy tilting wicks. Oh, you forgot. Of course you forgot. This becomes second nature. So when a person gets passionate about a mitzvah, he forgets it at Shabbos. So we said, you know what? Don't use it then. Don't use it. The other oil is not a mitzvah for it to burn. We don't have to be concerned. My Zayda Lavashon told me that when his father was sent into Siberia, well, eventually he was killed. So they had the little kerosene lamp or whatever. It was, you know, very long, long winter nights. Long winter nights. What are you going to do? What are you going to do all night? So my grandfather, when he came to be with his father, he smuggled in a Gemara Ksubis in his underwear. A tiny Gemara Ksubis. And he and his father, until his father was killed, he was actually in prison when his father was killed, but when they were together, they would learn Gemara a whole time. So they had one Jewish book, the Gemara Ksubis. My grandfather, Av Shalom, knew the whole Gemara Ksubis Baal Peh. Why? Because Teir Shalamad Ba'af, he learned that under the angst of Stalin. And he told me that he remembers his father learning on Friday night, next to this little kerosene lamp, and he would take his hands and wrap them behind the chair so he shouldn't, chas v'shalom, sin of temptation. So he's not going to learn, kafti. It was a waste of time. And he would stand together with my grandfather, look at the limb, and he would hold his hands like this. He was very litvish, very frum litvak. He would hold like this, holding his hands tight. They shouldn't mindlessly, because and somebody gets caught up in learning, you know, it's like, it's mindless. You don't realize what you're doing. You understand? That's why I can't use it on Shabbos. Doesn't that make sense? Makes sense. So what's going to happen now? The Gemara makes so much sense. What's going to happen now? Somebody's going to ask a question. can't just leave it, right? So, yeah. Makes too much sense. Let's take a look at Rashi, by the way, before we go further. Rashi says, Ulasreifa imid. It's ready for being burnt. So Rashi says, Sha'asr ba'achila. You're not allowed to eat it. So what are you going to do with it? You got to get rid of it. Shemitzvah olav levare. It's a mitzvah to burn it. Dilma osi be'li de takolo da'achila. Maybe you'll end up eating it. Now from Rashi, it doesn't seem like what I told you. It doesn't seem like it's actually a mitzvah. But from Rabbeinu Parachia, it does. Rabbeinu Parachia learns differently. Rashi, it seems, it's not a mitzvah. Rashi seems the mitzvah is to make sure you don't do the wrong thing. But others maintain there might actually be a real mitzvah over here. But even a mitzvah, a rabbinic mitzvah, is also a mitzvah. Shema yata, kideshi is bar mar, it should burn more quickly. Oh, Marle Abaye. So Abaye says to his teacher, Rabbe, he says, teacher, Elo meyato, if so, be Yom Tov lishteri, it should be permissible on Yom Tov. Why should it be permissible on Yom Tov?
No.
Why no?
Because human nature is really, has got no control of certain things. And you'll start using it for Shabbos, not thinking.
Very good. What you're saying is actually correct, and the Gemara is going to answer it. It's called loy plug. We can't make distinctions. You know what the most famous example of can't make distinctions is? When do we make a bracha? Before we do a mitzvah or after we do the mitzvah?
Before.
Now tell me a mitzvah, specifically you, the ladies, tell me a mitzvah that you first do the action and then make a bracha. Lighting candles. Why?
Because
once you say a bracha, you say Asher Kedishanu with Seisiv, you mention a formula, a prayerful formula of Shabbos. Guess what? It's Shabbos. You can't light candles when it's Shabbos. It doesn't work anymore. So what do? So therefore you cover, you go like this. I don't want to see the candles. Don't look at it. Don't look at it. Cover your eyes. Then you make a bracha. Then I'm using. So there's no, the action of lighting the candles has to precede it, but at least I cover the light. So one second. Simple question. That's a problem for Shabbos. But on Yom Tov, you're allowed to light candles. So on Yom Tov, you should do it right. First make the bracha, lahadlik ner shel Yom Tov, and then light the candle. The Prisha, one of the commentaries on the Torah, his wife asked him the question. She was a Lamdonis, a learned woman. She said, it doesn't make any sense.
It gets back to habit.
Oh, so what did he tell her? Shabbos candles, Yom Tov candles. Candles are candles. Holy candles, holy candles. Once you start making a bracha before and then lighting it on Yom Tov, somebody will end up doing it on Shabbos also. That's just the way, that's what human nature is all about. It's called old paradigms. We get stuck into a paradigm. Once you get used to something, it's very hard to break us out of the paradigm, which could be a healthy thing sometimes. We get used to doing things which are right. And if you start doing things, well, sometimes it's right this way, sometimes, very confusing.
Well, the thing is, the same thing happens when you go out for an aliyah. The first bracha, you should say, with your head tilted away from the sefer tefillin.
This is true, but what's the connection?
Of making the bracha on the sefer tefillin before you enjoy the beauty and the...
That is correct, but that's a proof the other way. That's the bracha you make before.
Yes.
We always make the brachas before. When else don't we make a bracha before, incidentally? When else? When we wash our hands.
Yes.
Why don't we do it before? Because some of the times when we perform hand washing, we're not allowed to make a bracha yet. And what's the third time? The third time is immersion in the mikveh. Well, why wouldn't we make a bracha before we go into the mikveh? Biblically speaking, only two kinds of people can make a bracha on the mikveh today, because they actually have a mitzvah. A woman can make a bracha on a mitzvah, and a convert can make a bracha on the mikveh. So, make the bracha before. Well, not so simple. Can a convert make a bracha before?
No.
He's not Jewish yet. How can he say, Asher Kedushan Ben Seis Vitzivonu? So first he has to dunk, then he comes out of the mikveh, then he's a Jew. He says, now I can make a bracha. So what taka do they do? A woman immerses once, then she makes a bracha. The convert immerses, then he makes a bracha, and then he immerses a second time. There's a logic to this. Understand? These are the three things that you make a bracha. It's not really connected to any of this, but it's the same idea. Abaya says, "Biyomtif lishtri." Who says not? He says, "What do you mean? Halama tanan? Why do we learn in the Mishnah? Ein madlikim b'shemen sreifa biyomtif. You don't light shemen sreifa on yomtif." So the Gemara answers, "You know why? It's very simple. Gezeira yomtif atu Shabbos. Once you do it on yomtif, you end up doing it on Shabbos. So you have a gezeira. The gezeira is keep it uniform." Keep it clean, that's all. Rashi says, "B'yom tov, deleka l'meichesh l'hatoya." There's nothing wrong with tilting the wick. It's permitted. Lishtari should be permitted to do that. So he said no. Oh, Marav Chizde. So at this point, everything is fine and dandy. We answered all the questions. Everything makes sense. We know what Shemen Sreifa is. We know why you can't use it on Shabbos. So we even know why you can't use it on Yom Tov. Comes Rav Chisda and says, Rav Chisda Omar, Leshema Yate Lechai Shinon. What are you talking about? We have no concern of Shema Yate. No concern. Well, if we have no concern of Shema Yate, meaning lest he tilt, why can't you use this oil and these wicks? Isn't that a no-brainer? Now, I want to tell you, and when we say Rechista doesn't hold of Shema Yata, it doesn't mean in an absolute fashion. Shema Yata, lest he tilt, is found, generally speaking, in two ways. One way is when we talk about oil which doesn't burn well. It doesn't move up the wick easily, so it sputters. And therefore you constantly have to adjust the wick because you don't have a clean and naturally burning fuel, a sputtering fuel. And those kind of fuels or oils you cannot use on Shabbos. You know why? Shema Yata. Rav Chisda agrees then, Shema Yata. But Rav Chisda says, what I'm not worried about is a person violating Shabbos in his zeal to do a mitzvah. I'm not worried about that. And here perhaps, and this is the Shayim speak about this, it could be that if Chista says, if Chista, it's not really a mitzvah. It's a technicality. I have to get rid of it. If we learn that it's a mitzvah, like Rabbeinu Parachya says, and Rashi even alludes to it, if it's a mitzvah, I might be worried somebody get carried to the mitzvah. There's no mitzvah over here. I don't care how long it takes for it to burn. There's no mitzvah. It should be incinerated, because if it's not incinerated, we have a problem. You have another way to do it, fine, do it your way. You want to dump it into the Atlantic? Okay. Understand? So, from a Chista's perspective, and this is not implicit, we're kind of reading into the Gemara. If we are to say, and it's not my idea, this is written, but if we follow the Mefarshim, say the Mefarshim, that maybe there's a distinction between whether or not it's a mitzvah to burn the Tumah. That's the question. The Karbon, for sure, is a mitzvah. The Torah says do that. The Tumah is not, the Torah doesn't say it. The question is it the same kind of thing? The Chachamim, the sages, create a mitzvah like burning the korban. In that case, it's a mitzvah. So if it's a mitzvah, I'm worried somebody gets carried away in the zeal and zest to perform the mitzvah. But it's not a mitzvah, rather a technicality. So what does he care if it burns? I mean, I violate Shabbos? Why bother thinking that way? You understand? So the Chista is saying, well, I don't hold Shema Yata. I don't think anybody would ever come and adjust. It doesn't mean he never thinks somebody would come and adjust it. When a person is trying to see something and the flame is sputtering, of course he might adjust it. But he says, it's not a mitzvah. It's not a mitzvah. Why should he adjust it? Okay. Well, how do we learn the Mishnah then, according to the Chista? We have a problem here. Because the Mishnah says you can't use it. So the Chista says, the Mishnah is talking about a very narrow circumstance. What's that? The Mishnah is talking about Yom Tov Shechal Lihiyot Erev Shabbos. Yom Tov, so Friday is Yom Tov. If Friday is Yom Tov, when do we light the Shabbat candles? This happens sometimes. We have
before Shabbos comes in
on Friday. On Yom Tov,
yes.
On Friday on Yom Tov. And he says, that's the problem is, she'ein sorfin kodshim b'yomto. We have a principle. We don't burn sacrificial or sacred offering matter, substances that were defiled. We don't burn that or incinerate that on Yom Tov. Why? Because the fire of Yom Tov is not a fire of destruction. It's a fire that we benefit from. Understand? So here's the problem. There's no problem with it burning on Shabbos. But since Erev Yom Tov, since Erev Shabbat is Yom Tov this year, when will you have to light the candles? Erev Shabbat. On Yom Tov still. And on Yom Tov, you're performing an act of burning or incineration, which is not permitted on Yom Tov.
So why is it different from Shabbos?
Because on Shabbos, we didn't light anything.
No.
On Shabbos, it burns by itself. And the problem is kindling. The problem is not that it would burn. That's famous halacha vilcha Shabbos. If I could start something going, and then it continues to go, there's no issue. I'm allowed to cook on Shabbos, but if I put my pot on the fire before Shabbos, no problem. Shalom. Cook away, man. But maybe somebody's going to adjust the thing. Okay, we have a blech. You have to cover the fire. So this is a totally different perspective. In their first perspective, on Shabbos, we said it should be prohibited. On Yom Tov, it should be mutter. From Chista's perspective, it's exactly the opposite. On Yom Tov is a problem. Shabbos should not be a problem. So Gemara says... Gemara says, "V'hamida katani sefer." But since we learned in the end of the Mishnah, "Ein madlikim b'shemen sefer b'yom tov," you're not allowed to light the shemen sefer on Yom Tov. Miklal derech shalav b'yom tov askinon. You have two cases in the Mishnah. The Mishnah always goes like case halacha, case halacha. You gave us a case, not specifying, telling us when it is. The second case is Yom Tov. If the second case is Yom Tov, what's the first case? Not Yom Tov. If it's not Yom Tov, what's Reb Chista talking about? Reb Chista said the first case is talking about an Erev Shabbat that is Yom Tov. Omer Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Chanina says, no. Mesura. This is like a continuation. Ma tam ka omer. What's the reason that we said this? Like the Mishnah explaining itself. What's the reason that we said that on Erev Shabbos you shouldn't light Shabbos candles with Shemen Sefer when it's Yom Tov? What's the reason? The reason is Emadlikim Shemen Sefer be Yom Tov. Why? Why Lefi She'ein Sefer Kachem be Yom Tov? So you said that the second case is Yom Tov. How could the first case be Yom Tov? Said Reb Chisda, the second case is explaining the rationale behind the first case. It's not a second case. It's a rationalization. It's an explanation. Final Rashi on Daf Chav Gimel. V'hu tzarech la'adlika mi b'oi jermin, has to be lit on Erev Shabbos before the Shabbat arrives. Nimtza, Seyrif Kodshim b'Yom Tov, comes out, he's incinerating, he's kindling Kodshim, this holy matters, on Yom Tov. The Gemara says, well, the Kaman b'Pirkin, later on in our chapter, Yalfina Mikroi, Dein Sefer, we're going to see how we prove from an actual pasuk in the Torah that you don't burn Kodshim on Yom Tov. We'll see why. Then we'll talk about that later. The Gemara now says, you know what? Rav Chista is right. He's right. Tanya kavaseid Rav Chista. We learned in a Braisa something very similar to the teaching of Rav Chista. Now, if we find a Braisa that seems to speak along the lines of what Rav Chista interpreted in Mishnah, that becomes very compelling proof. Remember, Mishnah and Braisa are of the same genre. They come from the same time. The Amoraim, the rabbis of the Gemara, are discussing what the rabbis in the Mishnah, the Tanaim, what they meant. Now what happens if we find a Tanaic source that seems to indicate the very same logic that Reb Chisda wants to read into the Mishnah? Well, that's very compelling proof that this Mishnah what must be saying that. That's what the Gemara tries to do now. Tanya kavasei de Reb Chisda. Kol elu shomrei madlikim b'Shabbos. All these situations, these kinds of fuel that we said you're not allowed to use them on Shabbos, madlikim b'hem b'yom tov. You can use it on Yom Tov. Why? Why couldn't you use it on Shabbos? Shemayate, lest you tilt. You're going to increase the fire. On Shabbos, you're not allowed to do that. But on Yom Tov, that's fine. On Yom Tov, you could take a fire and light another candle. So he says, all the things that we're told you're not allowed to use on Shabbos, all those different fuels that sputter and don't burn in a clean fashion, which would maybe put us in a situation we would mindlessly or thoughtlessly tilt or fix or adjust the wick. On Yom Tov, there's no issue over here. Chutz. It's one exception. What's the exception? Chutz mishemen sefer. With the exception of the oil that has to be burnt. Why? Says the Braisa. This is not rabbis in the Gemara. This is not the Amoraim. This is a Tanoim speaking. Says the Braisa. Lefisha ein serfen kodshim be Yom Tov. Because you're not allowed to burn kodshim on Yom Tov. Understand? So once we establish something like that, now we see a very clear and compelling proof that the notion that you're not allowed to burn it on Yom Tov is different. And this, I told you this before, that when Rav Chisda says he doesn't hold of Shemayata, he doesn't think Shemayata is an issue. When does he not think Shemayata is an issue? He doesn't think Shemayata is an issue when it's talking about a mitzvah, because he doesn't even say it's not even a mitzvah, he says. When would we have an issue? We'd have an issue if it would be something which physically doesn't burn well. Then I have a real concern. Then I have a worry. So in general, with regard to the notion that we will make a gezeirah, we'll make a decree, a fence, we have a rule that we don't make a gezeirah l'gezeirah, a fence for a fence. Because once you start making fences for fences for fences, you're protecting the protective measures. Protective measures are put in place. Now you want to protect the protective? So the rule is ein eisen, ein eisen gzeder l'gzeder. And the question becomes, it seems here, by being worried about mixing up Shabbos and Yom Tov, we're making a gzeder for a gzeder. So Tosfos talks about this. And Tosfos' answer is, chode gzederi. It's one fence. It's details of the same fence. It's not considered a separate idea. Separate idea would be a separate thing. It's not a separate idea. It's all one basic principle. An example. You're not allowed to eat meat and milk. The Torah says. You're not allowed to cook meat and milk. You're not even allowed to benefit from meat and milk that's cooked. What about poultry? That doesn't say we can't have poultry. It says you can't have meat. So we say, but not really, it's not the same idea. A chicken is not a cow.
It's a fence.
Oh, very good. Now we have other fences. We have other fences. Like not only you're not allowed to eat meat and milk, which is cooked together, but in fact you're not allowed to take a cold piece of pastrami and a cold piece of cheese and eat it together. Why not? The Torah doesn't say you can't. It's a fence. How about chicken salami? Can you have chicken salami with cheese? No. Why not? Turkey roll and cheese. What's wrong? The turkey, it's a gzeda to a gzeda. It's a fence to a fence. So the answer is the same idea. That's the basic idea. When it comes to milk and meat, we have a multi-layered fence. It's not a different fence. It's one fence. And the same thing, we have a fence. It's a big fence. It's a strong fence. It's the same thing when it comes to protecting the integrity of Shabbos and ensuring that people don't mistakenly, unwittingly, unthinkingly violate the Shabbos. We have various fences. But ultimately, all of these fences are all part of the same thing. Now, another interesting thing is the fact that this Gemara, curiously, gets interjected. The very next piece of Gemara goes back to Hanukkah. It's a curious thing of how this kind of landed right in the middle. Right? Clearly, there must be some kind of connection between Hanukkah and between Shabbos. And some of the Mefarshim say that we would be concerned with the Hanukkah menorah on Shabbos. So in other words, yes, it's true. On Hanukkah, you could use Shemen Sefer. And incidentally, this is the only thing a Kohen could use today. A Kohen can use Shemen Sefer. Our Kohenim are not certain they're Kohenim. We're certainly not in a state of ritual purity. But if you know for sure you're a Kohen, you're not in a state of ritual purity, you may use Shemen of Truma to light your menorah. But not on Shabbos. Why? Because the mitzvah of burning the olive oil may end up getting you into some serious trouble. Shemayata. And because there's a Shemayata, there's a crossover between Chanukah and between Shabbos, so that's why the Gemara finishes off with this discussion of what seems to be a discussion about Shabbat, but it's really a discussion not only of Shabbat candles, but it's a discussion of Chanukah on Shabbat. The next Gemara will no longer be talking about the mitzvah of lighting the candles. We've concluded the discussion of lighting candles. The next Gemara, the next sugya, is going to talk about the prayers of Chanukah. We know the prayer is called Al HaNisim. Where do we insert the Al HaNisim? Do we insert the Al HaNisim only in our prayers? Do we insert the Al HaNisim also in the Berachat HaMazon? Do you have to repeat Berachat HaMazon again if you didn't? These are observances of Chanukah. Is it a mitzvah to have a meal on Chanukah? There are other discussions about Chanukah. But at this point, we conclude our discussion. The Gemara concludes its discussion for all practical purposes of the actual kindling. So we went back to the last thing that wasn't discussed, and that is a unique situation where the one thing you wouldn't be able to do is light the Chanukah menorah with this candles, with this oil, on Shabbos. And that, my dear friends, is the story of burning the mitzvah oil. Thank you for joining us, and please come back next time. Khalif, now you have to hit the live button. No, right here, this one.
I'm going to go around.
It's
your job.
But this is a new thing. We just did it for the guys who are in Florida. They wanted to watch the class, so.